You may not remember me, but I work here. It's good to be back from Thailand. I'm wearing my Thai tie with elephants on it. I'm wearing it on my shirt. For about 30 years, America's cultural liberals have understood abortion as a secular matter of individual rights where the mother, but not the baby, is seen as a rights-bearing individual. Conservatives have framed it as a moral issue based on the assumption that life is sacred in and of itself and everyone has a right to it. Under Roman Catholic teaching, when push comes to shove, the baby has a greater right to life than the mother, since it stands to get a bigger quantity of life. I expect the Roe v. Wade decision to be overturned during President Bush's term, and I think that the majority of American citizens now do believe that abortion is primarily a moral issue. If this is the case, America's liberals need to begin doing what I think we should have done 30 years ago. We need to reframe abortion as a moral issue rather than an issue of individual rights. And if we believe abortion is morally justified, we need to develop moral arguments for it that can be persuasive not only to us, that won't accomplish much, but eventually to a majority of the voting public. I believe that this could be done since I first preached on abortion 15 years ago. I don't think it's quick. This week and next week, I will try to persuade you and hope the picture that I sketch is solid enough to begin persuading others. To tackle issues like this is to risk failure, and you may not be persuaded. You may certainly decide that I fail at this. Still, it's too important a subject to be ignored. A new discussion has to start somewhere, and this is a good place to start. For it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. For our centering, I brought questions. Is life sacred? Is it always sacred? If so, what makes it so? Can we ever assume the authority and the right to say no to life? Through birth control, family planning, abortion, capital punishment, or war? Ever? If so, how, when, and why? These are questions likely to be more profound than answers. Let us not approach them lightly, or we will do a great disservice to them, to our subject, and to ourselves. Let us first be humbled by the subject of life. Is life sacred? Always? Who are we to pronounce on it? And how? We are here through the accident and gift of life. If we would deny that gift to others, how, when, and why would we do it? Let us begin by letting the questions settle in and being humbled by them during the silence. Well, this is an embarrassment of riches today. You do know the service goes to 2:30. I want to treat this subject in two sermons, and today will be the shorter part of the argument. And next week will be the longer part of the argument. I have agreed with the conservatives from the start that abortion is fundamentally and irreducibly a moral issue. I have disagreed with them from the start on the subject of whether abortion can be defended morally. It's always been clear to me that it can be, but it's also been clear to me that it must be. So I've never fit in with either side of the argument. It's a huge subject. Part of what I'm arguing is that we already have all the information we need. We already all understand all of the terms of the argument. We just haven't said them out loud. And then there's a surprise coming in the piece of the argument that I'll bring you next week, and I'll tell you that at the end today. It's the teaser for next week. I think that you have to frame the discussion of the morality of abortion, the morality of limiting life, of saying no to life, against the background of what the meaning of life is for that kind of life. It's one thing to say no to the life of a mosquito. It's something else quite different to say no to the life of a human. So I want to start with a very simple discussion of the meaning of life. And it's a common sense discussion that I think is something we all know. It was first formulated by Aristotle, as far as I know, over 2,300 years ago. It's very simple. So the meaning and the purpose of any life is the pursuit of the peculiar kind of excellence available to that kind of life. A dog's life is about a different thing than a horse's life, or a bird's life, or a human's life. But the success of a life is measured by its awareness of and pursuit of, and sometimes even achievement of, the peculiar kind of excellence available to that kind of life. Now, this is easier said than done, and it can't be done alone, but it also means that those responsible for the society have as their primary responsibility putting in place the structures and laws that can encourage the development of that kind of life's peculiar form of excellence, and stopping those things which prohibit the development of that peculiar form of excellence. This is something we all know and we've seen in a lot of areas. You can look to dog breeders, horse breeders, cat breeders, anyone who knows a species well, and find what they're using to govern their breeding rules. And what they're using, I was married for 6 years to a woman who bred, raised, and showed a rare kind of dog. If the breeders are successful, you won't even have heard of it, because they didn't want it ever to be famous. It's a sheepdog, a French shepherd called a Briard. It's still my favorite breed. And for 6 years, I attended dog shows and I attended programs and lectures on breeding. And we went through our own studies to find good breeding for our own dogs. Those who breed each breed of dog write up the standards by which that breed will be judged. Those who breed the dog are the ones who know the species the best, who theoretically love it the best. And they're the ones who are describing what the peculiar form of excellence is for that breed of dog. And dog shows are about judging how well this species has lived up to its peculiar form of excellence. You don't get credit for doing something that's not in your breed's repertoire. Greyhounds get no extra credit for being able to herd sheep. That's funny, but there's a profound point there. It isn't that the more things you can do, the better you are. It's that you need to be the kind of thing you are the best. Sheepdogs get no extra credit for being able to retrieve a pheasant. It isn't what they do. The reason that Briard owners hope that you've never heard of their breed is because there are two concerns when you talk about the quality of life and the meaning of life that are diametrically opposed to each other. You can only value one of them, and the other will suffer. So you have to make a choice. And that's whether you're going to value the quantity of life the sheer fact of more numbers or the quality of life, the development of that life into its own peculiar form of excellence. And what dog breeders and breeders of other good animals want to guard against is overbreeding, which always destroys the standards of the species. Briard owners know this because they've seen what happened to Irish setters when they became popular. And if you've owned an Irish setter, you know the long list of physical ailments that setters come with now as part of their genetic package, from runny eyes to other problems with their body. You know, if you have owned German shepherds or Old English sheepdogs, that because of overbreeding and breeds that became famous and popular and sold well, these dogs were reduced to things rather than being considered as creatures in their own right with their own peculiar form of excellence. So now German shepherd owners and Old English sheepdog owners know that they can look forward to their dog spending their final years in pain from hip dysplasia that's due to bad breeding. Quantity trumped quality, and the animals became structurally incapable of pursuing their own peculiar kind of excellence. These are things we all know. In our species, it's more complicated, and it's certainly more demanding. Ancient writers, the Greeks and Aristotle, used to write famously that humans are in the unique position of being caught midway between, as they put it, the beasts and the gods. And I think that's true, with all due apologies to the beasts. But we have a kind of self-awareness that dogs don't have, as far as we know. We worry about who we are and who we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to live in ways that horses don't. We worry about whether we're models of a good life, whether we're the kind of people that our parents and those who love us can be proud of in ways that I don't think ever occur to pigeons. In many ways like this, we can count ourselves as above the beasts. We know we're going to die. That's a background of everything that we consider in life. We have an existential angst that collies don't have. I know Briards don't have it. So we are above the beasts in some ways. Our peculiar form of excellence has some things in it that dogs and horses cannot do, involving self-awareness and development and sensitivity to so many things: music, arts, literature, each other, relationships. But we're not gods. We're not omniscient, we're not omnipotent, and we're certainly not eternal. We can articulate more than we can actualize. We can see more than we can be. We yearn for things we have never yet achieved. And that yearning is one of the highest marks of our humanity. We yearn for peace, for justice, for societies where people are treated like children of God rather than as things used to serve the ends of others. We fail. And part of what the distinctly human problem is the continual struggle between high aspiration and low inspiration. Without that struggle, we're not quite human. We haven't arrived at the level where humanity needs to struggle to discover and develop its own peculiar kind of excellence. It's a vulnerable excellence available neither to beasts nor to gods. So you could see our history in some senses as a struggle between a glorious vision and an often vainglorious reality. But we know what a human looks like when they've succeeded at becoming exemplary. And if you doubt this, try this mental experiment. Imagine some benevolent aliens have landed here, and they come to you because you're obviously a person of such discernment and character that they would seek you out. And they say, point out to us people, either living or dead, who exemplify the best that your species can do. Now, we'll all have different lists, but you have this list. Mine's quite long. I might point to someone like Martin Luther King as someone who had a vision of wholeness during a time when visions of disharmony dominated, and who had the moral courage and the vision to stick to that. And I'd say this is what we hope for from our prophets, and at our best they can do it. I might point to Einstein or Darwin as people who show what human intelligence can achieve at its absolute best, at levels so high that they beggar the minds of the rest of us. Or I point to Bach or Mozart or Ravel or Picasso, Homer, Shakespeare, and say this is what the human spirit can do when its creativity is combined with the genius that produces something uniquely human. I'd point to the firemen and the policemen from September 11th in New York City. I'd point to the firemen who died going upstairs that others were rushing down because a kind of compassion for their kind of people drove them up in more ways than one. I point to long lists of teachers, doctors, nurses, cops, clerks, and business people who in ways small and large have shown through the courage that it takes to live high values that they exist to make a positive difference in the world around them, to be a blessing to the world as they pass through it, and to make things a little better because they were here. And I'd say that's what we can do at our best that dogs don't do, horses don't do, chimpanzees don't do, that no other form of life we know of can do, and that not even the gods can do. The gods may inspire us with visions of a better world. Only humans can make it. And at our best, we've done it, and it's magnificent. And I would say that those laws, those conditions, those values and ideals that allow that to happen are those that honor the sacrality of human life. Now, that's tilting toward development, toward quality, not toward quantity. You'll have to choose. You cannot honor both quantity and quality in any species of life. I don't think anyone expects exemplary quality from the lower forms of life. I've never heard anyone talk about a really outstanding fire ant. We don't talk about a really remarkable noble pigeon. That's not the way we judge them. We judge them more by whether they've survived, and they've survived because they've bred a lot. Breeding is a very high calling for lower forms of life. Development is the high calling for higher forms of life. Take your pick. You can have one, but you can't have them both. It's easy to say life is sacred. Talks cheap. But to act in ways that recognize what is sacred about life and further it are much harder. I'm going to end in midair here, because we are in midair, and ask you to take with you for a week these questions and let them get inside of you. Is life always sacred under all conditions? Or are there times when it should morally be disallowed? And a moral argument's necessary, I think. The Protestant Reformation began almost 500 years ago with Martin Luther's belief in the priesthood of all believers, and I share that belief. I think that the struggle to find life-giving truths doesn't rest just with ministers, it rests with everyone, and I invite you into the struggle. But I'll give you one teaser for next week, when I'll talk about the morality of abortion.